This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Earlier this year, the Trump administration issued a 120-day ban on refugee admission to the U.S. That ban has since ended, and new, stricter screening measures are now in place. And according to advocates, all of this is having a chilling effect on the number of people seeking refuge in the U.S., but the global refugee crisis shows no signs of slowing down. The United Nations Refugee Agency says we're now witnessing the highest levels of displacement on record. More than 65 million people have been forced from their homes and are now on the move. Sajal Nasrallah has made it his mission to both help refugees and immigrants who are looking to make a new life in a new country. His work has taken him to places around the Middle East and to cities here in North Carolina. And he's quite familiar with the story of what it means to be displaced. His father is a Palestinian refugee, and most of his family still lives in refugee camps in the West Bank. Today, we meet Sajal Nasrallah and hear his story. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Let's talk about your work with refugees. Most recently, you had been working for a while for World Church Services, right?
Church World Services.
Church World Service, forgive me. Church World Service, up until earlier this fall. Tell us what you were seeing in refugee resettlement.
Totally, absolutely. So refugee resettlement, you know, as many people know, has been a really big part of American humanitarian identity for a very long time. However, during the recent election, and I think really following after the intensification of the Syrian civil war and a few other sorts of attacks that happened in Europe, there was heightened Islamophobia that became part of, you know, the campaign for Trump's election. So around that time, this topic, which has been enjoyed bipartisan support, actually became really divisive and very politicized. That has kind of really divided Congress and people in the Democratic and Republican Party around what this issue is and how it's represented in politics. It was pretty drastic. And around that time, with its roots in the Islamophobia, we've seen this messaging really works, that this campaigning really works, this kind of scapegoating, this kind of right-wing populism is actually working on a global scale, and it has impacted our governance here in this country. And so really what was at stake for us more recently, and this from my perspective, coming from a family has refugee roots and an immigrant perspective, is that this was a fight for belonging. This was a fight for maintaining even the most basic benefits of citizenship that we've had in this country for a long time. And this was a fight for the narrative of what it means to be a migrant.
But it was, part of it was also the fear that there had been refugees who had refugee status in Paris, for instance, who were behind terrorist attacks there, and that the United States and every country needed to be more vigilant and take a look at, as you say, there was bipartisan support for allowing refugees, 65 million people now displaced, on the move. Certainly open your hearts to those people. However, should we now not be a little bit more cautious given the experience in foreign capitals?
You know, we've seen that. We've seen that narrative popping up more now on more conservative ends of the political line, where people are saying that this actually, the question of welcoming is a question of national security. And we say, no way, you know, that this thing does not come with strings attached. This thing does not come with these heightened levels of phobia, these heightened levels of scapegoating and xenophobia. I mean, we need to call it what it is. We need to call it that. That there are entrenched issues around poverty, around displacement, around really terrible working conditions in this country and other countries in the world, and who's being blamed for it but the people who people least understand. It's not a question of national security, and that's been proven over and over again.
What's the effect, though? What's happening in terms of refugee resettlement? There's a couple of ways to ask this. Number one, we know fewer refugees obviously are getting into the country because they've been restricted. Once they get here, is the resettlement effort, how has that changed, or has it, in terms of allowing people to get started and get their feet under them once they get here?
So I'm not going to speak so much on like the specific dynamics of like what happens when refugee resettlement is being enacted, like when a person comes here and the steps that happen. I think that's a far more detailed and completely different. It's a different conversation. But I think one of the biggest impacts is that, one, I mean, the numbers are lower. Mm-hmm. The numbers that the United States is accepting are drastically lower. They've never been this low. I think, you know, if there are even refugees coming right now, there's less than 50,000 nationally. But I think one of the biggest impacts is that the folks who actually are coming now have really lost a sense of what the promise of resettlement is. Even when one of the huge guarantees of being resettled into a third host country, most likely in the Western world, is even the United States, one of the big guarantees was like some sense of security, some sense of opportunity. That has been deeply compromised. For many people, through the experience of colonialism or war in their home countries, they already had questions about that. But now, considering what governance looks like in this country, it's deeply in question, especially considering there are still large numbers of refugees who are coming to the U.S. who are, you know, or who were coming to the U.S. who are Muslim, who within the first year of being here had to really like deal with the ideas like, whoa, am I being resettled into an environment that is, again, unsafe for me? And so I think the question really here was like, that I saw in community organizing anyway, it was like, the question is like, how are we going to like really address this issue of belonging? And how are we going to convince even more deeply now, more than ever, people to step up, to talk about what they care about and step up to really fight for that promise, fight for that benefit of citizenship that they've been longing for.
And you have a family history in this, at least in being displaced. Your father is a Palestinian refugee living in the U.S. Tell us your father's story. Take us back a little bit.
Yeah, he's a compelling guy. I would often describe him as he's super joyful. He's very curious, and at the same time he's rigid in interesting ways. I mean, he's definitely in like an old dog kind of guy. Essentially, you know, because of where he's from, I also consider myself as being from Palestine. We're from a area called Ain Suba, which is in the foothills of Jerusalem, or Al Uts, as it's known in Arabic. And the Ain Suba is on gorgeous land. I mean, some of the most beautiful, fertile land. There's still lemon trees and olive trees and orange trees in this area. It's just completely gorgeous, fresh running water that runs right through it. The Ain in Arabic is the well, so that it was named after the well that it was standing on. But he was actually displaced in 1948, him and my entire family. And
because of the creation of the State of Israel.
Because of the creation of the State of Israel. And my uncle was killed at that time. And they moved into a rural area, which is still on like kind of the eastern parts of Jerusalem, that is now called Al Izariya. So Al Izariya is now like a pretty much a full fledged town in the West Bank. It used to be about a 15-minute walk to actually the old city of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. but since the creation of the separation wall or the apartheid wall, it has been. It's actually impossible for a lot of my family members to go there. So they haven't. My uncle and some of my cousins have never been in their entire lives. And my uncle hasn't been able to actually see or pray at the Dome of the Rock in about 40 years.
What did your father do when he was there?
My father, he moved through a lot of different experiences. Because my family was what we called falah. Falah in Arabic is like from like a peasantry class or like a farm worker class. He was a shepherd. So a lot of my uncles and aunts and ancestors, they basically tended to the land. They made olive oil. They picked and cultivated crops and sold them at market and then sustained themselves off that same food and off of the meat that they had from their animals, from their cattle. So a large part of his childhood was actually, especially in fleeing, was caring for the assets that we had, which was that cattle. That's what he spent a lot of his life doing, and wasn't able to like really fully be in school because of those responsibilities. So he would move in between school and go take care of the animals, you know, pick fights with other kids who were shepherding as well, catch snakes, milk goats, you know, all the things that kids do.
So he was living a kind of rural lifestyle. talk about land ownership. I mean, it's interesting to think about the legality of this because, as we know, the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, Palestinians were removed from their land. Their land was taken from them in creating the State of Israel. Mm-hmm. What claim do you have to that land? I mean, other than what was the way with their deeds? I mean, how did that work?
Yeah, actually, we still have documents from the Ottoman Empire saying that we have about 200 dunams of land in Mineia.
So dunam is a unit of measure.
Dunam is a unit of measurement. In that area, it's probably like a little more than an acre of land. And even around that time, like, you know, these things are generally, that's a document, right? You know, in all sense of legality, that's a document, you know, whatever, if it's binding or non-binding, it's a document. But, you know, in the sense of that time, that things were more arbitrary, things were more communal, they're based around nobility and different sorts mm-hmm. of things like that. They weren't really fully captured by Ottoman bureaucracy. But in the legality of this, I think the question of legality isn't really on the side of...
Well, the family had been there for generations.
Oh,
we've been there for 400 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just wondered, I did wonder, you know, what the bureaucracy was around then mm-hmm. and how they were able to move freely and how it worked so well for those many, many generations. And
absolutely.
Of course, the New Order comes in and supported by the... Western states in their creation of Israel, and off you go.
Absolutely.
Well, let's continue this conversation with Sajal Nasrallah, an activist and community organizer who works with refugees in North Carolina. More of that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Sajal Nasrallah is the first member of his family to have been born on U.S. soil. His father is a Palestinian refugee. Most of his family lives in refugee camps in the West Bank. Today, Sajal is an activist and community organizer who works to support refugees who are displaced from their homes, and he joins us now on the State of Things. We're talking a little bit about your father working as a shepherd, rural lifestyle. One of 13 kids, right?
Mm-hmm,
so your grandfather had to make some choices about who gets educated and who doesn't.
That was absolutely the case.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah. There was a lot of uncertainty all of the time. As I understood it, and when people describe my grandfather to me, he was pretty discriminating against, like, let's say, who's going to be in this role of leadership, which one of my sons is going to be in this role, which one of my daughters is going to be going to school, and how are we going to be making money? So at different times, my father was taken out of school. I think at second grade, he actually was helping fruit sellers in the street for some spare change in the market streets, and then also learned how to crack wheat between stones at a very early age, and then also helped learn how to chisel stones for construction at different points in time. But it was always something that he really detested, and how he described his experience with my grandfather was that, like, he just really wanted to go to school. He was really motivated by that. He really loved the connection. He really thought that was really his passion in life, was to, like, be in his books. And so despite the fact that a large part of his childhood was spent having to work and having to, like, really sort of just hold these big responsibilities at a really early age, he would find ways to get access to books to read. He would find people who were going to school and barter with them so that they would come and, like, tutor him after school and things like that, which is eventually how he ended up graduating high school altogether and pursued it's really surprising, but he actually was able to pursue a PhD, receiving scholarships because of his grades.
He went to
Damascus University in Syria, which had was accredited under a French system, and then from there got a scholarship to NYU, which is how he is the only person on my father's side of the family who has actually left Palestine.
Tell us about what he did, because he also became involved in politics in Damascus, right?
In Damascus, not so much. In Damascus, he was keeping his head low. In Palestine, and this has been a huge impact on me in terms of his experience and his retelling of these stories. In Palestine, especially in his high school age, he was part of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. It's called the PFLP. It's kind of a socialist Marxist organization, which was running in a trend at the time. You know, when you think about this in terms of, like, you know, Cold War politics around the time, it was running in a trend around socialism and Pan-Arabism. around that time? Like, what would it mean? How would our power be more greater if we could unify all these Arab states to this idea of socialism? And how will our enemy, which was Israel and settler colonialism at that time, be? What are the consequences for our enemy, basically? So he actually staged a protest at his high school that was organized and supported by the PFLP, and he was a leader in that organization, leading the Falah, like I told you before, like the Falahin, which was the peasantry farm worker class of people, which eventually led to his detainment and imprisonment for a period of time. But that was his kind of definitive political act around that time before he ended up leaving to Damascus.
And then he went there. Does he talk about that? Does he talk about that experience of arrest and what happened around that?
You know, he only tells us the funny stories, the good stories. He has typically had a history of sheltering us from some of the harder details, which I used to resent, but I've come to appreciate a little bit. He tells us about how him and his friends would kind of pick on the guards and play games and things like that, like fake ill or like throw stones at them and just, you know, whistle as if they weren't, you know, doing anything. It's like, sounds very like Looney Tunes in his retelling, but I totally appreciate it. It sounds great to me.
When he went to the university then, did he leave all that behind? What was happening as he's now trying to pursue his PhD and he's going to eventually get to New York?
Yeah. I think he was in a tough contradiction, and the way he tells the story, and I really know this very deeply about my father, is that he has been processing a deep level of guilt for a very long time around having left and having been able to pursue these advanced education opportunities and pursue opportunities that have allowed him to really travel across the world. I think he witnessed essentially the 67 war while in Damascus, as well as another incursion in 1971, while he was in Damascus, that he was just watching on the news. You know, he was just reading in the papers, and he was hearing stories about, you know, additional times. Like some of my uncles had to flee again, essentially from Al-Azariya into Jordan for a period of time for safety, and he had to see some of his sisters do that as well. And he carries a lot of grief around that. I think, yeah.
Tell us about his time then in New York. He went to NYU.
Ended up going to NYU. I love my dad. He has been able to do so many amazing things. He studied comparative literature at NYU. He was really interested in language, really interested in philosophy. And honestly, I think he was also really interested in, like, being something, you know, really trying to carve out a place for himself and something that he saw and dreamed about as having a lot of integrity, which was being a professor, being a doctor of philosophy and comparative literature. And he studied with some pretty awesome minds. You know, he studied with Edward Said, who, you know, when I was reading Orientalism in school, he gave me his copy with some of his markups in it and things like that. And I mean, he really talks really glamorously about that time. And we found out much later in life, about some of his friends, some of his acquaintances, some of the parties he went to and things like that back in the day. But he talks about his life in Manhattan really, really dearly.
And let's pause your father's story for a moment and get to know your mother a little bit, because her story was a little bit different. Tell us about her.
Yeah. So my mom's family, in terms of, you know, they're also Palestinian, but they have a different history. Basically, my grandfather left Palestine to go to Jordan in the 1930s, where he was just sort of like incredibly savvy businessman. I think this is something that kind of runs in our blood. My brother's got a little bit of it. I have zero. I just missed that mark. But he started doing water fixtures and creating water fixtures for construction companies and things like that. All of my aunts and my uncle and my mom were born in Amman, Jordan, but then they found more opportunity in North Africa and ended up moving to Libya at a pretty early age. So the way my mom's childhood has been always framed to me is like, oh, we were on the beaches of Tripoli and Libya and everything was great. And we had a great company at the time. We were making a lot of money. We were always wearing Italian bikinis and petting tigers at the zoo. And it's like, okay, this is just a completely different narrative. Yeah. And the pictures we have all, you know, are that we have of that time are all like very exact. But actually, they ended up leaving Libya as Gaddafi was coming to power, because there was strict nationality laws about where wealth could be concentrated and who could own businesses. So my grandfather, who was, you know, Palestinian Jordanian, had to basically get as much of his wealth together, pay off as many people as possible, and make it back to Jordan.
And how'd your mother and father meet?
My father, after graduating from university in NYU, got a teaching job in Jordan at Irbid, so at Yarmouk University. Mm-hmm. And my mom was his student in comparative literature.
So he goes back. He'd been to the United States. He comes back and meets your mother.
He comes back. He really had a hope to reconnect with his life. I think there was different parts of his life in Manhattan that were kind of coming to an end. And it was a good opportunity to be close to home, not exactly home, but be pretty close.
And what about religion? What role did Islam play, both for your mother and your father, to that point?
To that point, I mean, Islam has been a huge, powerful and like really powerful force in my family's life from both of their experiences, especially I think my father's side. I think Islam was something that was really a source of salvation, was a source of refuge, was like a place to feel and contain power within the family, and it had so much guidance within it for them. As for my mom's side, they actually didn't become more religious. They were definitely Muslim, but they didn't become more religious until the 1970s or so. And that was actually very much paralleled with the rise of kind of Saudi Arabia in the region, believe it or not. So they've actually become much more conservative now, my mom's side, in ways that I don't necessarily respect. But it has been a really important part of my upbringing, our growing up, and our identity.
Well, let's talk about your upbringing. Yeah. That means we have to bring your parents to New Jersey or you don't enter the picture. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, my father had ended up losing his job in Yarmouk and was thinking about coming back to the United States before his green card expired. Ended up making it back, finding ways to get his green card back. My mom came. My brother was born in Jordan, and my mom came, and I was born in Lyndhurst, New Jersey, which is like kind of like a bridge and tunnel folk outside of Manhattan, you know, little small towns, and then really close to Patterson's is kind of where we spent a lot of our time. Browntown, that's how we call it. And
a real mix of ethnicities there, right?
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah. Totally. We were like in Greek neighborhoods and Polish neighborhoods, Arab, Turkish, Afghani, you know, just super diverse.
So, and you didn't stay there. You left when you were around 5 years old for Charlotte, right?
Yep, that's right. Came to Charlotte. I mean, we had one cousin, like kind of second or third cousin, who was living in Columbia, South Carolina, who had been around for quite some time. So my family was like, oh, let's take a road trip down and go visit him. And let's stop along and see some cities along the way and see like, well, you know, what could we find? Where could we find a place to stay? Ended up passing through Charlotte. And Charlotte around that time just had a lot. You know, my dad at that time, he was in retail.
What year is this?
This is like 1993, 1994, yeah. Kind of passing through Charlotte around that time, which was kind of growing. He was in retail, so construction was pretty big around that time. So selling carpet and flooring at different retail companies was totally a viable business, a viable way to make income. So they loved it and ended up staying.
You talk about that because you were in high school during the September 11th attacks happened. What was that like for you?
I was actually in eighth grade. I was in eighth grade at the time, so I was finishing middle school. And I usually tend to define that experience as like I didn't really have a good sense about. I had a really strong sense of my identity from a cultural perspective, from like a religious perspective. I knew that I was Muslim. I knew that I was Palestinian. I knew that was something to be proud of. I didn't really feel necessarily targeted or problematized. You know, I knew that where my family was. I knew what Israel was doing. I knew about the way my family was displaced, but not so much to the extent of my own personal experience. And I think what had happened at 9/11, it was huge definitive moment where I had to really grapple with every single detail about my family's experience, from like the names of my cousins to my identity to my background to my heritage to how my family and my people being represented in movies to and then like as being a kid, you know, I was also like not the coolest kid in the world. I was already bullied, but then like my bullying took on like this racist nature. So I was like, oh, what is this thing?
Well, how so? I mean, what was happening?
I mean, you know, my whole family is, you know, we're my whole family, my whole identity. I mean, literally, you know, turn on any Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. That's like my cousin, you know, every detail about the way that Muslims are being targeted or stereotyped. In terms of the superficial things like the names of people, the identities. I mean, my last name is Nasrallah. That did not go well for me in a lot of places, and neither for my parents. I like to frame it from my father's perspective that he was stateless. You know, to come to the United States and to get citizenship, even in like you know the 80s, you know, like early 90s. And then see this new heightened targeting xenophobia and racism that's like targeting him and his identity, and also like that later led to the Iraq War, which totally impacted our community here in the United States and our community and our families' lives in Jordan. That was huge. You know, that was huge.
And he even understood this. Tell us what he did in the right after 9/11, understanding immediately what this would mean. I understand that he planted a flag in front of his business.
I mean, everything shifted around that time. There is a lot of fear. The only other example that my family knew and our community knew about how this country responds to an attack on its soil was Japanese internment camps. That was something that people were talking about. And so we hung an American flag on literally everything. There was an American flag at our house. There's an American flag on our car. Around the time my father had lost his job. So he opened up a small flooring company, which we still have today. He made the colors red, white, and blue. He rented a jackhammer and he dug and he broke the asphalt and with quick dry cement hung an American flag out front of his store.
So how much of this, again, are you internalizing? Are you taking this from them? Are there conversations around the table now? Be careful. Are you looking at the news and saying, oh, my God, they're talking about me? Or are the things happening to you that suddenly make you realize, again, as you said, I'm now having to take my whole history, everything about me from my name to my looks to my heritage, into account in ways that before that day you didn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if something happened to you or if you just read the paper and say instantly, uh-oh, they're looking at us.
I think the way that I had to sort of deal with this was when I was grappling with what it meant for me to be politically active, what it meant for me to kind of speak up like when I was in college, to be part of organizations that were interested in building power for people, that were interested in really challenging these global trends of imperialism that were targeting my family and my people. And what happened at that time is I realized that I was carrying a lot of fear around what it meant to step up, what it meant to tell people what I care about in an interpersonal sense and on a public platform. I mean, the very fact that I'm here saying the story to you is pretty monumental considering a past version of myself that carried a lot of internalized fear of surveillance, internalized fear of being targeted or my family being targeted. Then these are stories that my family was sharing with me. They're like, Sajel, you're not the person to go out there and say stuff like this. You're not the person to put yourself on social media like this. You're not the person, or you are the person who will likely be targeted.
And there are very real efforts to censor these kind of conversations even in advance.
Oh, absolutely.
Too. So you know that, and totally. We know that too. So these things are very real. They're palpable. They're out there. So I want to talk to you briefly about going back to the camps, because much of your family is still in the West Bank, your father's family, and you did go back to visit, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about that.
We've gone back a couple times when we were kids. That was definitely more of like an experience of being able to see some of the holy ground that is there in Jerusalem. That is like the Al-Aqsa compound there, praying at the Dome of the Rock, things like this. These things were huge pivotal experiences for me. And, you know, we definitely saw the huge military racist infrastructure that was part of anyone's experience going to Jerusalem and the kind of stress of that. You know, we definitely saw that. At a later age, though, when I finished college, I made a determined attempt to basically travel in the Middle East. I wanted to go to Syria. I spent time in Damascus, Aleppo, Lebanon, Egypt, and spent a lot of time in Jordan being with my family and doing some art projects there. And then one time ended up following some of my cousins back, crossing the border from Jordan on the Allenby Bridge into Jerusalem, and went to go see some of my father's side of the family for the first time, some of the extended part of the family who was living in refugee camps, most of the people that my father had been sheltering me from, and kind of those kinds of experiences. Yeah, it was completely life-changing. I think one of the first drastic experiences was actually being interrogated at the Israeli border. I'm an American citizen, but to them, they see my name. And I was being asked repeatedly to answer for myself. I was being asked by every single person I interfaced with who I am, what I'm doing there, how long I'm staying, what my intent is, do I have an agenda, and that I did not belong there. That was being reinforced every step of the way. And after 8 hours of waiting and interrogation and being told that I'm lying and different levels of humiliation, people were opening up my diaries and reading things out to me and asking me to answer to them. I eventually made it in to see this gorgeous, beautiful, robust part of my family, all of whom were still living in Laizaria.
I want to hear more about that experience when our conversation with Sajal Nasrallah continues, a Durham-based activist and community organizer. Our conversation on the state of things continues after this. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Sajal Nasrallah, who is a Durham-based activist and community organizer working to support refugees in North Carolina and abroad. We left you at the West Bank, where you, after 9 or so hours at the border as a U.S. citizen, finally got in. What was that like when you saw that extended family of yours?
It was definitely a funny experience. After finally making it through the border, I took a cab a little ways out into the West Bank and waited for one of my cousins to come and collect me. And it was just awesome. I mean, I was just like, here's this person, looks like me coming. It looks like my family coming here to talk to me. And the first thing he says to me is like, welcomes me, greets me, kisses me. And then he's like, we need to get a haircut because you're going to go visit all of your family. Immediately takes me to a barbershop where my father's childhood friend was the person cutting my hair. And then we drive down into the neighborhood where my family lives, and people just knocking on the door, opening the window, being like, hey, do you know who I am? Hey, do you know who I am? And I'm just like, no. And then like, a couple of my aunts just like slapping me. I mean, they're like, who do you think you are? You don't know who we are. So it was beautiful. And it was actually a day that my cousin Waleed was getting married. So his wedding was happening upstairs. So there was food, festivities, all these people were there. And then we just kind of like, I actually just like came into this whole world that my family has been living in for the past, like, 60 or so years at that time, in just dancing. I was just dancing all of them. It was just so wonderful.
You talked about the difficulty you had getting in to see them from the outside. They have a hard time seeing each other, too, because of the way things are cut up in that part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, we have family who are living in Amman, Jordan. We have some family who are living in the West Bank. And we also have family who are actually Arab Israeli. So they're living in areas close to Ain Suba, which where our family's originally from. They're living in a town called Ain Rafa, which is well known because it's nearby Abu Ghosh, which is a well-known town. So they're separated from each other by citizenship status. And
So what about you? You began then, this sort of changed your mind about what you were going to do, or at least got you more committed to the idea of working with refugees. Was this the moment that it happened for you?
Yeah, I think there was a juncture where, I mean, I was absolutely interested in working with not only refugees, but also just like my people. I wanted to speak Arabic. I loved the visceralness of that. I loved being in between two cultures, and I wanted that to be cultivated in my work life. When the helplessness and fear around being actually politically active was still happening, I was mostly seeking out work in nonprofits that were working with refugees in the U.S. So I was really connecting with like Iraqis and like people from Sudan, East Africa, and other like East Asian and Southeast Asian countries, and just sort of just talking with folks, making friends, and like working in these nonprofit positions like ESL instructor, sometimes case manager, and things like that. But then actually went back to in the Middle East anyway, in Jordan, worked in a art space that had like after school programming for Palestinian refugee kids. So I did some like music improvisation classes there. And then in 2013, went to Lebanon to do some studying and also to work as part of an oral history project that was working in Ain al-Hilwa refugee camp, which is one of the largest Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, and doing an oral history project from some of the people who were displaced from 1948, telling their stories and creating kind of a virtual map of their narrative.
What is that like for them? What is their understanding? Because this is now generations of people who were displaced after 1948, the creation of the State of Israel. They've been displaced as families for generations now. You're working with them, doing art projects. How are they processing? What are they saying about themselves and their situation?
It's very heterogeneous. I mean, there's a lot, you know. I mean, I would say that there are the experiences, I could say, in my family and the experiences that I've heard and the experiences that are part of the Palestinian diaspora all over the world move between people really accepting the idea that we've been colonized, accepting the idea that settler colonialism exists, that the Nakba happened, and now these are cities. And also the experience of we will return. That is a big part of also my family's identity, my family's history, and how my cousins who are my peers, like my age, who are living in the West Bank, feel about their conditions. They're like, I'm going to go in. I'm going to find a way to go in. If I can't get a permit to go in, I still know that we're going to win. You know, that's just an uncompromisable. So there's different levels to it.
And by winning, you're talking about sovereignty and self-determination.
I'm talking about like absolute the restructuring of power that allows people to return to their homes, that allows people to live in a democratic and actually democratic society.
Now, the Israelis would say, well, they're because of the attacks on their sovereignty, their national security, they have to impose these kinds of militaristic solutions. This police state that they've created is necessary to protect their safety.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's something that people would want you to think. However, the reality is more people die from peanut allergies than they do Palestinians. In that context, I mean, that's purely part of the agenda of being a settler colonial state to convince people that actually they're under threat. And I think the problem is it's not just Palestinians that suffer from that. It's also Jewish identity. It's also the diversity of that identity that has been whitewashed by a state that has convinced people that anti-Semitism is a worldview that needs to be protected by the State of Israel. I think. In my opinion, that Israel itself and Zionism itself is anti-Semitic because Judaism is a beautiful, glorious religious practice that has actually extended to all parts of the Middle East and the world, and that has been compromised.
When you talked about some of these feelings that you see represented, you talked about your own personal feelings now. Earlier, you talked about your father wanting to shelter you from this and perhaps carrying some guilt for having left the place unchanged. When he sees your work now and your activism now, how does he see your work, and does it change any of the way he wants to express himself?
That's a good question. It's been hard for my dad to see me become politically active, particularly because of the consequences that he's faced, and he is very cautious. He has actually instilled a deeper sense of skepticism in me, even when it comes for me to make a decision around being, you know, stepping up in any kind of way, you know, joining an organization, organizing a rally, anything like that, which are now things that I am actively
skeptical
part of.
What? Skeptical of their ultimate motives? Maybe watch out, see that's not all that it appears to be, et cetera?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. He's skeptical. Of leftist organizing across the board. That organizations may use you. That organizations may do these kinds of things. So it's definitely instilled a deeper fear in me, and also the consequence of what it means in this particular moment because of the conditions that we are in the society and the war on terror and these kinds of things. You know.
Right.
However, I will say that I feel like my relationship to my father has actually deepened as I've gotten older, and that part of my process of healing enough to be able to step up in this kind of way has impacted him. And I think even though some part of him superficially will want to say, just get a good job, you know, just take care of yourself, like just do the things that I know I don't have to worry about you. I also think that he really not only maybe like envies me a little bit, which he's actually admitted to, but I think he is deeply grateful for me.
Tell us about what you are active in and what you're doing these days in Durham.
I love playing music. I cook my people's food. Have a small catering project, which is steadily growing, and then also am a community organizer I'm very interested, particularly in building the Durham for All 10K Strong campaign. And
which is what?
Which is a campaign that's built on the principles of democracy for all, sanctuary for all, education for all. Did I say sanctuary for all?
You may have.
Sanctuary. Well, essentially,
repeating.
Right. building an agenda that is for the people of Durham to step up, to build, to step in and have the power to say how governance happens.
So, who are you
city.
Working with? What population?
Working with refugees and immigrants. So, the community that I've been particularly working with has been. In Durham, there is a large number of refugees and immigrants who live here. Some Muslim, some Arab. Some East African, some also, and also in this context, I also am identifying refugees as people who are fleeing from South and Central America, who actually do not have status, but have in all sense of the world a refugee experience. And basically, really trying to be clear about the stakes and what it means if we do not step in this moment and tell people what we care about. So the real practice has been about really building relationships and being in community enough with people so that people feel convinced that what we need to do is we need to move people to our stories, to our narrative, and shift power in a way that is accountable to us. And what that, in the bare bones, what that means is organizing events, having lots of conversations, knocking doors, talking to lots of people, holding trainings, and
Getting back to your father's concern, I mean, he's a guy with a PhD and legal status and, in fact, citizenship,
right.
And he's really worried about you sticking your neck out. Now, think about people in that condition. I'm wondering how the organizing goes for someone who doesn't have legal status, for someone who is the target of Islamophobia and has a tenuous status like refugee status. We see how quickly that can be pulled out from under you. How difficult is it to get people to organize and say to themselves, yeah, we want to speak out and get kicked out and all the other consequences we might endure? It sounds like a tough sale.
It is. You know, it's tough. Some people have been waiting for that, and some people are ready to get involved and are ready to speak and are ready to share their wildest dreams, you know, and that's great. And then some people who we really need to kind of be to be there standing with us have a lot of skepticism, and it comes out in a lot of different ways. It comes out with, ideas of like, oh, this isn't going to change. They're not going to do anything. Trust me, like, he's going to get impeached in a couple weeks. Like, trust me, everything's going to be fine. Nothing's going to impact us. This is America. You know, these kinds of ideas. And what has happened, especially with folks who have been on that side, is through the act of even being involved, of attending a rally or speaking to a group of people, or when the threat of our very own belonging and safety in this country or in this community was compromised, seeing the way that people would step up in solidarity, their lives have been changed by that, as have mine. And they have been convinced on the purpose of what we're doing, and they're convinced that we're going to do it together.
Is there any correlation to be made between that kind of watching others step out and what we're seeing with sexual harassment and sexual misconduct now, more women coming forward once women begin, women and men, begin to tell their stories? Is there any correlation that can be made there? Seeing people come forward and then giving you the courage to then add your voice to the number?
I think when I think about something like that, like what creates courage, what creates that possibility for people, I think it does come with a set of examples, you know. I can speak for myself. Like, I didn't really know what it meant to share what I cared about or to hold a rally or what the purpose of that was or to build an organization until I saw other people doing it, until I was organized to that idea. And then I think in terms of the organizing that we've been doing, I mean, there have been key people who have actually taken that risk and thrived because of it and have grown because of it, and then also have inspired others. And because that has been happening, more people have been getting involved.
Tell us about your music. You're involved in a couple of groups, so and that's important to you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've had a kind of like a solo multimedia and music project that's been going on close to 7.5 years now, called Dunams, which I told you before is a unit of measurement of land in Palestine, and you know my family's experience, and that has purely been about really exploring and expressing what it means to be Palestinian and living here in the South. It started very much as just this loose, free-form expression of that that I was so abstract I didn't even quite understand it, and has been refined over the years more and more so to be really playing on arrangements of like classical Palestinian songs and poetry.
I want to play just a clip right here before we run out of time. This is a song called Eat Syria, and we're going to play just a little.
Eater Syria.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to play that and just to give a sense of the range here. Eater Syria by the Dunhams, a music project founded by my guest, activist and community organizer Sijal Nasrallah. So what's going on in that song?
So this song actually was taken from time I spent in Syria around like the beginnings of 2011. So I actually was in Syria when Mubarak fell and had been watching actually on social media that people were organizing protests in Syria in Aleppo and Damascus, calling February 4th Day of Rage. And so naively, I knew it was like a police state and all these things. And many people would never talk about being politically active around that time. So I actually just kind of went out and casually tried to start like very low level conversations with people about what it means to be politically active. And everyone basically told me, I don't know what you're talking about. Get away from me. We don't trust you. And that song is basically an invitation into really being part of this revolution. And it's basically then singing in Arabic, Shufika Kfin Moldua, which means, what do you think on the subject, my neighbor? What do you think on the subject, my friend?
And that's open the conversation.
Oh, yeah.
We've opened it here. Sijal Nasrallah, Durham-based activist and community organizer, works to support refugees in North Carolina and abroad, currently an organizer with the global advocacy organization Some of Us. Sijal, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Budarski is sitting in today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.